Welcome back to all of our listeners to the third edition of Keeping Up with the Chemos on mirvetuximab. I'm Tracy Lynn Hall. I'm a gynecologic oncologist at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, and will be moderating along with.
Hi, this is Judith Smith, and I'm an oncology clinical pharmacist in gynecologic oncology here at McGovern Medical School in Houston, Texas.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Moore. I'm a gynecologic oncologist at the Stevenson Cancer Center at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center in Oklahoma City.
Hi, everyone. My name is Julia Canestraro. I am an assistant attending optometrist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
Hello, I'm Karen Lyle. I'm a physician assistant at McGee Women's Hospital at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
Well, with any new drugs, we always get a little anxious about what we need to follow up on and monitor, as well as what adverse events to predict for our patients. So, Dr. Moore, what are the most common adverse events that we see with the administration of mirvetuximab?
So the most common adverse event of note is the ocular toxicity, which affects a little less than 50%. And this ocular toxicity can have a variety of names. It can be keratopathy, which is ophthalmologic or optometric finding, dry eyes, blurry vision, all of those sort of form a spectrum, and patients can have more than one symptom. But we see this in a little less than 50%, but it's usually incredibly low grade and quite easily reversible with a dose hold and or dose modification. So that's one that sort of we really work hard to mitigate. The other very common one is diarrhea. It's about 30% of patients will have, again, very low grade and manageable with over-the-counter medications, diarrhea. So that's something to set expectations about. And in Forward One, we did see a lot of nausea related to infusion, but we didn't mandate pre-medications on that study, which now we recommend that as part of the management of patients. So I think that will come down quite a bit. So those are the main ones. It's notable that we don't see really hematologic toxicity. It's almost a non-event to have any degree of neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, or anemia on this medication. And the rate of neuropathy as compared to weekly paclitaxel, which is one of the comparator arms on Forward One, is markedly reduced. So it's a very differentiated toxicity profile. It's not no toxicity, but very different than standard chemotherapy. So it's a nice sort of alternative for a patient that's seen standard chemo.
What approach, Karen, are you taking with making sure that the patients have appropriate clinic triage and making sure your clinic nurses know when to reach out to you versus letting them just manage the side effects from the phone calls?
We're lucky enough to be part of a pretty big academic practice, and we follow a team-based approach. Any message that comes into the office is supposed to have an APP, a nurse, and a doctor on it. And it's usually nurses and the APPs who see the messages first because our physicians are busy, and not that everybody isn't busy, but they might be in the operating room all day. So the PA, nurse practitioner, and nurse are often the first ones to see a patient call with a concern. And we often collaborate together to say, hey, I can send a message and just say, hey, to my nurse, can you call them and do this? Call them and bring them in. But APPs are skilled and well-versed at symptom management for any chemo. We've been in our gyn-onc practices doing it for many years, and it just knowing when the right time is to bring the patient in, what can be monitored from home. And it is all about education to us and to the patients so that they know when to call in.
That's great information to know. When it comes to those ocular toxicities, how often should we be making sure that our patients are seeing their eye care providers?
As we mentioned before, they should have a baseline eye exam, and they're required to have an eye exam every other cycle for the first 8 cycles. But of course, if a patient has any change in vision, any irritation, then you should send them to be seen as well.
Dr. Moore, did you see in clinical trials any issues with, as you've moved into clinical practice, issues with treatment delays or the need to implement dose reductions due to toxicity?
We definitely saw that in the studies. You could see, I was just trying to pull it up, what the actual numbers were, but we definitely would delay. Anytime you'd have an ocular toxicity, you would delay until that ocular toxicity had resolved to grade one or fully resolved. And sometimes that happened within a week, and sometimes you had to push the next cycle out like 1 week. So dose delays were not infrequent. Dose modifications, though, were relatively infrequent. We don't have to dose reduce every time we have an ocular toxicity. If it was low grade, like grade one, and resolved really quickly, you can kind of restart at the starting dose, and then if it happens again, dose modify. So, you know, that's sort of what we've done, but most patients remain on the 6 mg/kg, which is the starting dose. And really those that did have to modify went to 5. It's really uncommon for someone to need 2 dose modifications down to 4. So most patients stay at 6.
That's really great to know that most patients are able to stay on the drug. With the exception of progression of disease, Dr. Moore, is there any reason you would take somebody off of therapy?
You know, I think it would just be, and this was really in the phase 1 setting when we're still really working on the mitigation strategies, but there were a few patients early on, like before we really understood adjusted ideal body weight, for example, where we did get grade 3 ocular toxicities and they were discontinued appropriately. So if we were to see that, you know, sometimes as drugs become available and more broadly used outside of clinical trials, you'll see some emerging toxicities. And so if I did have somebody who had that kind of grade 3 ocular toxicity, which we really have not encountered very, very much at all, that's someone I would consider discontinuing. Because the last thing you would want to do is permanently impair someone's eyesight. And again, we haven't seen that, but we would hate for that to happen because someone hears me say it's 100% reversible. That was on a clinical trial. Different people are enrolled once you're off a clinical trial. So significant eye tox, I would discontinue for. That would be the main thing though. You know, we really see so little grade 3 or higher toxicity. It would be hard to kind of come up with other reasons you would have to discontinue that weren't kind of patient choice for a toxicity that they just didn't want to continue with. Like, for example, my colleague, Dr. O'Malley, who enrolled a lot of patients on this study, had a patient who was responding beautifully, and she's a teacher and had grade 2 ocular toxicity and just was like, you know, I'm done. I can't risk this. I have to go to work every day. And so that was her kind of choice. So you may see that, but we would have tried to mitigate it and he did. But sometimes patients, they're their autonomous beings. So support them and move to something else.
Great recommendations for monitoring and follow up after the first cycle. Just curious, what is the expected? I think you said there was duration of response is around 7 to 8 months. Is that what?
Median. That's the median. That's the median. You know, so that's the median. So you have some patients going even beyond that. So it's 33% response rate. Reminding those that are younger, response means the sum of the lesions has decreased by 30% or more. So it doesn't include all the patients who benefit with a 20% reduction. But in response, those who respond, it's 7 months on the median. So that compares very favorably to monotherapy cytotoxics, you know, outside of an Aurelia label, where your response rate is 13%, very different.
Well, thank you again to our panel for all your great insight and expertise throughout this podcast series. As we wrap up the podcast on rituximab, do we have any good take-home points to share with our listeners? Julie, you want to start with you tonight?
As Dr. Moore touched on previously, just educating the patient, and this can feel scary for the patient when they hear that there's a potential for eye toxicity. So really just reassuring them that we have ways to mitigate and manage symptoms and ocular toxicity. And for most people, it does not severely impact their lives where they can't do what they need to do. And so just driving that point home to them.
From the APP perspective, do you have any good take-home points for our listeners?
Symptom management for APPs is not new. So utilizing us to help manage the patients as they receive their mirvetuximab is a perfect use of your APP.
Dr. Moore, thank you again for all your insights tonight. Any great take-home points for our listeners?
Yeah, this was fun. Just to come back to an earlier question on dose delays and reductions, just so that folks know what to expect. In the SORAYA trial that Dr. Matulonis read, 30% of patients needed delay, only 20% needed a reduction. So this really is a drug where most patients will stay at the starting dose. And then just kind of going back to the idea of clinical benefit for our patients, because we do studies with defined endpoints, response rate, PFS, that's how we get things approved. But then how we use them is really based on how many patients they benefit. What does benefit mean? And we actually looked at this. This was a poster that was at ASCO last year, really trying to capture not just the responders, but those sort of stable disease, 20% reductions, et cetera. And that was 51% of patients had some kind of benefit on their CT scan. Participating on the SORAYA study, about 46% had a drop in CA-125. So that's kind of the clinical benefit message to this medicine, which is really, I think, more clinically relevant to those, all of us who are taking care of patients with resistant disease. This is what we all want, a response, but sometimes you're real happy if it shrinks a little, someone feels better and it holds for a long period of time. So you can move on to the next thing. And that's, I think, what we have demonstrated here. So I think that's more clinically relevant sometimes than talking about response rate.
This is truly great information. We truly appreciate all of the time from our speakers. And thank you so much to all of our listeners for joining us as we talked through the administration and the follow-up for mirtuximab.
The information presented is that of the contributing faculty and presenters and does not necessarily represent the views of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology or any named company or organization providing financial support. Specific therapies discussed may not be approved and or specified for use as indicated by the faculty or presenters. If you like what you heard today, please let us know by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and hitting the follow button wherever you're listening. If you have suggestions for future SGO On The Go podcasts, please email us directly at education@sgo.org.